You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. Talking about the Braves with Mark Bowman and taking a look at the philosophy for building the 2016 roster and how it's kind of an interesting transition year, how busy this winter will be. Talking Miami Marlins with Joe Fusaro, will be updating Giancarlo Stanton's situation and taking a look at the 2016 starting rotation. Talking Mets with Anthony DiComo, we'll be talking a lot about the postseason rotation and some of the questions as to how the Mets set up for these last few days of the regular season. We talk Phillies with Todd Zielecki, we'll be taking a long look at the outfield, plus checking up on Michael Franco. And talking Washington Nationals with Bill Ladson, taking a look at why the Nats fell short and taking a particularly close look at both the 2015 bullpen and what the 2016 bullpen might look like. The Mets got a little bit of a scare this week with the news that Steven Matz had some sort of mild back ailment. Let's start by asking you to talk Mets fans back off the ledge a little bit as far as what exactly is going on with Matz, because it does not sound like it's that serious right now.
Well, there's no talking Mets fans back off the ledge with Matz or with anyone, really. We've spoken on this podcast before, talking about how, you know, the Mets are going to make the playoffs, and there's just tends to be a fatalist attitude around this team sometimes where you can't say things like that. Well, it's happened now, so we can talk about this stuff, and we can talk about how someone like Steven Matz, who woke up wrong, had a little discomfort in his back. Normally, it wouldn't be a big deal, but it becomes a story because, A, the playoffs start next week, and he's going to be a part of that rotation, and B, we've been down this road before with Matz. This is a extremely injury-prone guy historically. We had not a similar injury, but a similar situation back in July where, you know, he woke up feeling something a little funny, said something. The Mets played it off as no big deal. He wound up making his next start and hurt it worse and wound up missing weeks. So, you know, while you kind of have to take what the Mets are saying at face value, that this isn't a big deal at all, and ultimately I don't think it is. They still have him slotted to pitch this week. They still tentatively have him slotted in that playoff rotation. You'll probably get an official announcement there sometime early next week. But Terry Collins said it himself, you know, you have to be wary because of this guy's history. And I think that's certainly part of the reason why the Mets are looking at Matz in the rotation instead of the bullpen in October, because they don't want to mess with this guy's routine, given all that he's gone through with Tommy John surgery and a long road back and injuries along the way and so on and so forth. They just don't want to put him in situations where he's not comfortable. But as for this specific injury, you know, everything that we know right now, it shouldn't be a big deal. He should be good to go for this week against the Phillies and good to go going forward in October.
If he is healthy, is it pretty well set that he is the number four starter in the division series?
Yeah, I think he's earned it. I think he deserves it. I think, you can certainly sit there and make a case for Bartolo Colon, just because of how well he's pitched over the past couple of months. But frankly, no disrespect to Colon, I don't trust that. Every win he's gotten, every good start he's pitched has been against the Phillies, the Braves, or the Marlins. And you're talking about three teams in the bottom five of major leagues in offense, three teams that are filled with young hitters, guys that are ripe for exploitation, which is what Colon is so good at. Not that he can't succeed in the playoffs, not that he can't succeed against the Dodgers or the Pirates or the Cardinals or whoever else the Mets wind up playing down the road here, he just hasn't proven it. And Matz's stuff is off the charts for a left-handed pitcher. You put him in a rotation with Noah Syndergaard, with Matt Harvey, with Jacob deGrom, those four guys, all of whom throw 95-plus, some of whom can get up into the upper 90s. Even, we've seen DeGrom hit triple digits this year. We've seen Matt Harvey hit triple digits in the past. Obviously, Syndergaard is capable of that as well. It's their best chance to win. I think the Mets realize that. I think, however tempting Mets might be for an inning or a batter in relief, like I said, the injury history plays into that. And just the fact that the Mets feel he's more valuable to them, giving you 5, 6, 7 innings in a start versus 1, 2, 3 batters in a relief appearance. It's just the fact, the more you're out there, the more you can help the team. And frankly, you know, if you're sitting on the other side and you're the Dodgers and you're looking forward to this series, who would you rather see? Bartolo Colon at age 42 throwing 90-91 or Steven Matz coming at you 95-96 from the left side? I think pretty much every hitter on that team, you know, if you ask them honestly, would tell you they'd rather face Colon. I think the Mets realize that, and it's pretty plain to see, both from their perspective and from anyone who's watched this team.
To take this one step further, is it in fact safe to say that we've got a pretty good read, barring a surprise, of not only the four pitchers but the sequence of them for the division series?
Yeah, well, the Mets have come out and said pretty much that Matt Harvey's not going to pitch twice in the division series. It's all part of, you know, the plan we've spoken about a million times that keeps changing. But right now, we're in a situation with Matt Harvey where when he's out there, he's good to go. He's good to go as he normally would, and that means you're not going to look at a Yankees situation where you take him out after five innings or even six innings or even 100 pitches. If you need him for 105, for 110, if you need him to pitch into the eighth, if his count is low, you can do that with Matt Harvey. Now, the drawback is that, no, you can't pitch him twice in a series. So the Mets don't particularly want to pitch him in game one or two because they want the guys who go in those games to potentially be available for game four and for game five. So I think it's certainly going to be Jacob deGrom and Noah Syndergaard in one and two. And that makes home field advantage all the more important for the Mets because they would much rather have Syndergaard in particular, given his splits, which admittedly have gotten a little better as the year has gone along. But Syndergaard has had for much of this year some pretty extreme home road splits. So all things being equal, the Mets would love to start him in game two at home. And the other thing about Harvey pitching game three is Terry Collins has said this. Sandy Alderson has said this. While every game in a best-of-five series is important, game three, no matter what, is crucial. Either you're up 2-0 with a chance to nail this thing home, you're down 2-0 in a must-win situation, or it's a 1-1 series tie, in which case, you know, you need that game badly. So the Mets would love to have Matt Harvey pitch in one of those situations, and that's what it's looking like. Then you have Steven Matz for game four, and you could potentially bring Jacob deGrom back for five with Noah Syndergaard available out of the bullpen in an emergency. It's a pretty formidable four-man rotation for a five-game playoff series. And while the Dodgers obviously have their horses as well, you have to like what you look at lining that up if you're the Mets.
Bill, it is now official. A season that began with really, really high, not just hopes but expectations, is going to end for the Nationals on October 4th. Not only disappointing, I think it's just really surprising. I don't think anybody either in or outside that clubhouse expected that. And it's as with so many things, if something goes really awry, it's almost never one thing. It's a lot of things. And if only one thing had gone wrong, they'd probably be in. But if you could point to one particular thing that really is what kept the 2015 Nationals out of the postseason, where does it start? What's the single biggest thing that went wrong that this club didn't get where it expected to go?
Matthew, there was a lot of things, but if I had to start with one, without question, it was the bullpen. It started when they traded Tyler Clippard away. They never replaced him. Casey Jansen was supposed to be the guy to replace him, but he didn't do the job. I mean, I think Casey Jansen will tell you that. He, as you remember, Tyler Clippard threw a blazing fastball. Casey Jansen kind of threw junk, and he didn't fool anybody. And it's not just him. I mean, the entire bullpen. I mean, once they acquired Jonathan Papelbon, things went badly. I mean, Drew Storen didn't pitch well. He was so angry he broke his thumb. And everything just went downhill after that. So, and Jonathan Papelbon was not a good influence either. He was not. And I don't think he'll be back next year either after what happened.
And this is really the interesting question to me, because this team, they spent so much and built so aggressively and really had a club that in every other way was exemplary. I mean, they had arguably what looked like maybe the best rotation in the National League, and then added to it. They had a lineup that, if healthy, and again, look, that's a separate issue, but going into the season, that lineup at every position looked strong, it looked deep, it looked like a lineup that could do a lot of things and beat you in a lot of ways. And yet, there were reasons before the season even started. This isn't hindsight to wonder about that bullpen. I think we probably talked about Casey Jansen in the offseason. He's been a useful pitcher, but it was hard for me even then to see him as a shutdown eighth inning guy. They had a bunch of kids who were interesting but unproven, and it's just weird to me that they went all the way kind of to the 1 yard line, building the rest of this roster, and then stopped short on the bullpen. I mean, in retrospect, I'm sure they would likely do it differently because they went out and got a closer in July. But what do you think was the reason for that? That they committed so heavily in every other area and kind of seemingly stopped a little short of committing to the bullpen that would flesh that roster out?
Well, again, it goes back to Clippard. They didn't want to pay Clippard, and he was on the last year of his contract. And, you know, there was a feeling that he threw a lot of innings, that his arm was about to fall off. But it didn't. And, you know, they thought that maybe Blake Treinen could be one guy who can help the bullpen as well. But he didn't do any better than Casey Jansen. So, I mean, I think that's where it starts. I mean, here they talk about, they brag about Blake Treinen's 98-mile-an-hour sinker. But, you know, I'm telling you, left-handed hitters really hit him hard. So, I mean, there was nothing impressive that he did in terms of that 98-mile-an-hour sinker. So, I mean, you got to, you know, I think they thought that their starting pitching would go deep and that you didn't need the bullpen as much. But as it turned out, the starting rotation wasn't as dominant. And the only one who was really dominant, if you think about it, was really Scherzer. And then during the second half, it was Strasburg. And that turned out to be it.
You mentioned that one way or another, it's likely Jonathan Papelbon is not back next year. And I think that's a fairly understandable thing. It would be hard to bring him back when he seems to have some sort of issue with the best player in the National League, who clearly will be here next year. But it's also going to be awfully hard to have Drew Storen back. I mean, even if they deal Papelbon or even just flat-out release him, whatever, even if Papelbon's not there, even if the door is open for Drew Storen to come back in the ninth inning, it is awfully hard to envision Drew Storen being back in 2016 as well. So, one, do you think that's true? Do you think the likely thing is that both of those guys are gone by opening day next year? And part two is the bigger question. Where does that leave them? What do they do about building a bullpen if the two guys who, when healthy, are two of the better relievers in the game, are both out and they've got nothing but the question marks who are pitching in front of them?
Well, number one, I think neither one are going to be back. I don't see it because they've told Drew Storen in so many ways that we don't believe in you in big games. They've said that many times, so I don't see it. I think they'll make a trade. In terms of trying to get a closer, they're going to have to either make a trade or develop one. And my guess is, at this point, there isn't a closer in the minor leagues that can help them right now. They're going to have to make a trade, and in order to do that, they have to give up a lot. And who they have to give up, I don't know. I mean, this is just an example. If you want to want a Rawlis Chapman or a Kimbrel, you're gonna have to give up some highly touted minor league prospect, maybe a couple. So who they give up, I don't know. But it's going to be hard for the Nationals to get that closer. They're going to have to develop one for sure.
Mark, last winter and frankly spring all the way up to opening day, you were as busy as any beat reporter in baseball. The Braves were as busy as any front office in baseball. As we enter the next offseason, do you anticipate another wild winter like that, or do you think that they have sort of done enough of the reshaping of this roster and this organization that maybe it'll be a little quieter this time around?
You know, I can't anticipated being any busier than last year, but at the same time, they do have some holes to fill, some questions to answer within their lineup, especially and in their bullpen. And you know, if you look at it, you can say that Freddie Freeman will likely is going to be their first baseman. Nick Markakis is going to going to be in the outfield, whether that's in right field or left field. We'll see. You've got Andrelton Simmons at short, and you've got Hector Olivera at third. Other than that, they have said that they look at Chase Peterson as their second baseman in the future, but his second half struggles have at least created a reason to look at Daniel Castro and other options there. Cameron Maven's second half struggles have also created reason to wonder, do you stick with him? You know, they had talked about trading him when he was hot earlier in the season. Now that trade value has been diminished significantly. And in left field, you've got Michael Moore and Nick Swisher. Neither guy should be viewed as an everyday guy, and Adonis Garcia. And obviously behind the plate, you know, while they would like to bring A.J. Pruszynski back, they do not – I don't think they want him to be the everyday guy again next year. And Christian Bethencourt, they have provided every indication that he has fallen out of favor, and likely they'll be looking at other options, whether that's Matt Wieters finding a guy on the trade market or Chris even just going to get a guy like Chris Iannetta. That remains to be seen. So, yes, there are plenty of questions. And like I said, with the bullpen, they want to add a piece or two there. And in the rotation – while there is depth, there is not a lot of experience. So there may be a need to at least look at the possibility to get a number three or number four guy who's logged some innings, a guy that some of these young guys can lean on. So, maybe it will end up being just busy. I just can't anticipate anything being as busy as last winter.
Philosophically, I kind of wonder about 16. I think it's a really interesting year because – you know, we talked about the number one pick, and there's been some talk about the incentives and just how generally if you're not winning this year, then frankly the advantage is to lose this year. But I don't think the Braves really like that, and it's kind of a weird year. And so I guess what I'm asking is, while certainly I would think that the plan is still on track and the goal is still to build for 17, to have a winning team to put in the new ballpark, do they view 16 any differently just in light of kind of how this season has turned? Do they do anything more just to kind of make sure that it doesn't peter out like this? Or do they accept that that's kind of the cost of doing business when you're trying to build for the long term?
I think that the embarrassment that they have felt over the last 2 months, which is self-inflicted. I mean, when you look at them, everything that they gave up in late July and what they got in return in terms of major league ready talent, it's not, I mean, nobody ever expects it to get as bad as it did throughout much of the past 2 months. But at the same time, you look at what they were left with their bullpen and how young their rotation was. And they had to know that they were going to struggle throughout most of these down the stretch here. And, there have been some signs of encouragement with the Matt Whistler, some of the young relievers like Matt Marksberry, that there, at least here the last couple weeks, there have been some signs of encouragement. But I do think this, the embarrassment of how bad things got probably will influence how aggressive they are during this offseason to at least try to put out a club or create a club that can play to a 500 record or at least remain somewhat competitive throughout most of the season. You look at it, it's been since – there hasn't been at any point since late July that you've even thought of the Braves as a playoff contender, and I don't think that sits well with John Schuerholz, who still has an influence on this club, and then obviously John Hart running the baseball operations. And you've got John Coppola, who has done a lot of the legwork. And, they have basically told him that, the three of them together have said, hey, look, we're going to do whatever we can next year to make sure it's not an embarrassment. And from a marketing standpoint, you're moving into a new stadium. You can't have two consecutive years like this and just say, hey, look, we're going to be able to sell tickets just based on opening up a new building, I don't think. I think you have to create some excitement. And at least erase some of the sour taste that has been created or that the fans have tasted over the last few months here.
Joe, we're doing a lot of year in wraps and looks ahead to the offseason this week, but your team had some in the now news. There had been hope and hope and hope that Giancarlo Stanton would come back and at least get some at bats before the year was out. That is now not going to happen. What was kind of the tipping point? What led them to just say, you know what, we'll get back after this next year?
Yeah, I think the key, Matthew, was last week, not this week, the final homestand. You know, the fact that, you know, he didn't even, you know, take batting practice or even test it in the cages because the hand kept bothering him. And it just kind of seemed like if he wasn't going to play in the homestand, the final six road games kind of seemed like an out. But in the final home game on Sunday against Atlanta, Stanton kind of told the reporters, he's like, hey, I anticipate going on the road. The team was off on Monday, open Tuesday in Tampa. Stanton wasn't on the trip, and even then, some people are saying, well, he might meet the team in Philly over the weekend, but by that point, Dan Jennings just kind of said, that's it. You know, we come to the conclusion. It kind of left it in Giancarlo's hands, he could make the call. They weren't pressuring him. He was measuring the difficulty of gripping the bat, just the lack of strength he felt overall in the hand. And apparently, Matthew, at root here is the scar tissue. He had an abnormally amount of it. It was also, the way his tendon wrapped around that hamate bone. It kind of created some discomfort when they kind of put everything together. Everyone's saying he should be fine for spring training, but, he missed 3 months on an injury many thought would be 4 to 6 weeks. So, it's going to be very interesting to see where he is. And obviously, when you take an MVP caliber player out of your lineup for more than 3 months, your season isn't going to look as nice as you kind of were hoping. So, there will be a lot of watching, Stanton. Obviously, there was a hope to at least see how the hand would respond to a few games, if nothing more. And that just didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the big question to me. The club obviously is going to say, look, we're really optimistic. I'm sure they are, and I'm sure Stanton is really optimistic. But wrists, as I'm sure we've talked about, as one of those things that just is true, is wrists and hitters are scary. It's a little like shoulders and pitchers. It's just that thing you never want to hear, particularly for a power hitter. Is there, in your mind, any level of concern or uncertainty as to what Stanton's going to be at the beginning of next year?
Yeah, and I think we'll have some answers in the offseason, Matthew, based on if he goes back. When we were in New York a couple of weeks back, he went and saw a hand specialist the day after he took batting practice on the field at Citi Field. And that, to my knowledge, I think that was the last time he took BP on the field. And if he goes back to the hand specialist, or if anything in the surgical procedure wasn't just right, that could be a concern if they have to go back in. Now, everyone's saying that's not the case, but, time's going to tell whether or not there's a little more complication in there than just merely scar tissue and an awkward placement of a tendon and dealing with that. So, something I think we probably should get some answers, certainly by the GM meetings in November. And, just hope that, for Stan's case, the league's case, Marlins and all their fans' case, that there's nothing more to this than just the scar tissue issue and, just the slower recovery than anticipated.
With all of that said, it's very clear that the Marlins will be writing in pen Giancarlo Stanton into their lineup from opening day next year. And I think probably we have a pretty good idea of most of what the 2016 lineup is going to look like. They could certainly make a move or two. There are some things that could happen, but by and large, we've talked about Marcell Ozuna, but by and large, I don't get the impression there's sort of major surgery to be done on the lineup. It seems a little less clear as to what they do about the rotation. You've talked to and written and tweeted about going after kind of a dependable veteran, not a top-end guy, but somebody to provide innings. What does that rotation look like? You certainly got Fernandez. You'd have to think Cosart. They'll hope for Alvarez, but I certainly don't think you can assume anything. And then a lot of guys. Who knows about Kohler, a lot of the kids. What does that rotation look like beyond Fernandez and Cosart next year?
Matthew, it's interesting you mentioned that. And I'll tell you, as of this date, what we're talking with just a handful of games to go, they pretty much are assuming Jose Fernandez will be the opening day starter, and Tom Kohler will be the fifth starter, and Jared Cozart will vector somewhere in between. They are hopeful that Henderson Alvarez, who had shoulder surgery a couple months ago, should be fine for the start of spring training, but they're not banking on it. So they're not going into the offseason saying, look, you know, let's hope he's really good and he could be our number two. So they clearly are going to have to go look outside, you know, for something else. Pleasant surprise, Adam Connolly. Matthew, very, very strong in September. And, you know, a pitcher who was a number two pick several years ago who never really kind of flourished, but kind of stepped forward this year. He's, you know, showing missed bat stuff, striking guys out. He's a guy that could be a sleeper to make a rotation. Nicolino, as we talked about before, not an overpowering guy, but pure pitch ability. A lot of people like him as a number four type of guy. He'll factor in, but, you know, so basically on staff now, you would probably just go, as we're talking about, Jose, Kohler, Cozart, Nicolino, and Connolly. That said, they really feel that they need to get a frontline starter somehow, whether they try to pull up a trade for James Shields, a guy that made a play for in spring in the free agency last year, or, you know, they need to make a trade. Now, you know, we've talked about they don't have a ton of trade pieces. Obviously, things can get done. So, you know, I think in a perfect world, they get Mike Leake. They'd love that. I don't know if they could swing that, you know, based on where they are. But I think they're going to – payroll, all indications are, is going to go up, you know, a bit, you know, to a little more competitive level. And, you know, they're going to have to throw those resources at a free agent, just hope somebody wants to come here. You know, obviously it's a team that, you know, it's not treated free agents very kindly, and they got to deal with a stigma. But, you know, if they kind of keep the core intact, which I anticipate they will, kind of sell it on, you still got a Stanton and Jose, an attractive place to come play, that maybe they could get a Leak or somebody like that. And then I think on the flip side, and I'm not sure you're getting there in this podcast, but I think they're going to go all out for a closer. So I think those are kind of what they're going to look for. You know, if they could swing a Aroldis Chapman, it would be their perfect offseason. You know, so whether they can, you know, aim that high, pay that much for a closer, I think that's what you're kind of looking at right now.
Todd, and a lot of these this week, I've been doing some year-end wrap-up and look ahead to the offseason. But, of course, we've been doing that on Phillies for quite a while now. But I wanted to ask you, out of all these guys they've kind of cycled into the roster, particularly in the second half of the year, trade acquisitions and otherwise, what guys have really helped themselves the most as far as positioning themselves for next year and down the stretch?
Well, two guys immediately come to mind. The first one is Jared Eichhoff. He was basically the number four prospect in that five prospect trade for Cole Hamels. He's pitched very, very well. The coaching staff really seems to like him a lot. And this is a guy who, again, as I just said, the three big guys in that trade were Jake Thompson, Nick Williams, and Jorge Alfaro. Those were the top 100 prospects, according to MLB Pipeline. You know, Jared Eichhoff was a guy that, you know, hey, he could come in maybe and be a pretty solid number four, number five guy. But he's really pitched much better than that. And I'm not saying that he is going to end up becoming better than a number four, number five guy, but I think they're very, very encouraged that they might have something a little bit more in Jared Eichhoff than even they thought they might be getting. So he'd be my first guy. And then the second guy is Aaron Altherr, who kind of came up relatively late. And I think the play that you've seen from Aaron Altherr, a lot of extra base hits, very good defensively, some speed on the base pass. I think his arrival and just kind of that, you know, what can this guy do type of feeling that the front office and the coaching staff has leads me to believe that there's almost no shot that Dominic Brown is going to come back next season. They're probably non-tender him. I mean, if they do tender Dominic Brown as arbitration eligible, I will be very, very, very surprised. I say that again because I think Altherr has played well enough to warrant a much longer look next season.
Yeah, and that leads into an interesting question to me. One of the more intriguing areas of this club for next year to me is the outfield. I mean, it certainly looks like Odubel Herrera is entrenched in center field until he proves he can't do it. You know, that Brown is still around, but, you know, as you know, probably not next year. They've talked about bringing back Jeff Francoeur. I mean, Sweeney has impressed. They've still got guys like Cody Ashe and Darren Ruff. I don't know that I see a single real future star in there, but there are a lot of guys that, as you sort of were hinting at, they would want to sort through and maybe still don't know. I mean, how do you see the 2016 outfield shaking out?
Yeah, it definitely is pretty muddled right now. Like you mentioned, Herrera, to me, is safest guy to be in the opening day outfield, opening day lineup at center field. He played really well. So we know he's going to be in there. Altair, who we just talked about, I think he's got a really good shot. He's probably a favorite to be one of those two-corner outfielders on opening day. Now, like you just mentioned, the rest of those guys, there's a bunch of guys that really have not asserted themselves this year. Now, assuming all these guys are back, and who knows if that's going to be the case, but Cody Ashe, I think coming into the season, based off his 2014, they really thought that he would take another step forward offensively and was a guy that could hit 15, 20 on a great year, 25 home runs, anywhere between 70 and 90 RBIs, kind of like a solid number six hole hitter, kind of like the numbers that Pedro Feliz put up in 2008 at third base when he was with the Phillies. But he fell well short of that. He's just over 10 home runs. He has just over 30 RBIs, and that is just not going to get it done. So if he is coming back next season, it's going to be probably his last shot to really prove himself. Now, personally, I think it would be in their best interest to re-sign Jeff Francoeur, not because they necessarily need his bat, but he's just a tremendous example for a lot of these young guys in that clubhouse. You know, this is a team right now. Aaron Harang probably won't be back. Jerome Williams probably won't be back. Chad Billingsley won't be back. You know, Cliff Lee certainly is not coming back. They need a veteran guy in there to kind of show these guys the ropes, show them how to act in the clubhouse, on the field, off the field, you know, show them how to get through adversity and how to handle things. And you'd be an ideal guy doing that. Now, if they do not re-sign Jeff Francoeur to be kind of a fourth outfielder, I expect that they'll go out and try to find another veteran, because they certainly do need another bat in that lineup, and they certainly do need another veteran bat in that lineup.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.